from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. What if someone were to tell you that most published research findings aren't true? Well, it turns out that a number of scientists have been saying just that for years. Here's how psychologist Todd Kashtan put the problem recently when he reviewed some of his own published studies and found them wanting. For those of you who aren't scientists, Kashtan wrote, you need to know an important truth. Just because research is published in a peer-reviewed journal does not mean that it's good science. In the hour ahead, we'll look into why some scientists are questioning the research we use to make decisions on everything from nutrition to healthcare. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. We like to believe in research. We like to believe in data. And when research data gets published, we like to believe it's true. So consider this headline from last year. 4 decades of federal nutrition research fatally flawed. The story in Science Daily went on to report that according to a University of South Carolina report, 40 years of nutrition research funded by the Center for Disease Control relied on seriously flawed methodology. Increasingly, researchers are calling into question the validity of some published research, a calling out that started 9 years ago when Dr. John Ioannidis published an influential piece called Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. Now, Ioannidis and colleague Stephen Goodman are leading a new initiative at Stanford University to try and encourage better research practices, research that plays an enormous role in the decisions we make about everything from public policy to personal health. Joining us for this hour of Forum are Dr. Stephen Goodman, who is a professor of medicine at Stanford University and co-director of the new Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford, or METRICS. Dr. Goodman, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Dr. John Ioannidis, professor of medicine as well at the School of Medicine and the fellow co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. Good morning as well.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone this morning from the University of Virginia, professor of law Barbara Spellman, who is the editor-in-chief of Perspectives on Psychological Science. Professor Spellman, thanks for being here too.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Thanks all very much. So this begins with something that almost feels contradictory, Stephen Goodman, the idea of validity of published research, because you sort of make an assumption that if it's published, it must be valid. Not so?
Well, that's a very, very complicated question. So there are all sorts of pieces of the process by which people hear about that research. One is the data itself. And we're not necessarily claiming that in the vast majority of published studies that the data itself is false or fraudulent or anything like that. But we do know that what we see published is just a small slice of what was actually done. So this is where it all starts. So the question of what slice are you seeing is the first question. Then there's the question of what sort of conclusions are being drawn. And sometimes the data can be absolutely right, but the conclusions are a little off or may not be completely justified by the data or by the science that even went before the study. And then finally, there's the media, all of us on this show, and what is chosen to be highlighted and broadcast literally and figuratively. And at every step in those processes, things can fall down.
Give me an example of something, either of you, that is sort of your textbook example of the kinds of problems that are any of those three categories that you referenced, that maybe the data was fine, but what was either picked up by the media or what was highlighted in the report was not something that was really that valid. What's an example, Dr. Ioannidis, that comes to mind that frequently gets attention and maybe was not deserving of such?
I think that there's many medical interventions, for example, that have been proposed to be widely used by the population based on studies that were done with the best intentions and by the best scientists. For example, things like vitamin E or hormone treatment in postmenopausal women. We had several studies that had been done by excellent teams. They had been published in peer-reviewed journals. They suggested that by taking hormones, you can cut your risk of major diseases like having a heart attack or several cancers substantially, or the same thing for vitamin E or for beta-carotene. And probably that was just a slice of the evidence. Probably there were additional studies. And then we had the benefit of having some very large studies with more stringent designs, with randomization and long-term follow-up of participants that showed that practically there's no benefit. And in the case of hormone treatment, there was even harm.
So is part of the problem then, to add to the list that Dr. Goodman was building, that it's the first study is one that gets attention, and perhaps because it's reporting something novel. But then when it's later, the attempt is made to replicate it or to further assess it or done with a larger sample size or whatever, that it doesn't pan out, and that may not also get as much attention?
This is also a very common problem. You see that all scientists, we're under a lot of pressure to try to generate significant results and major discoveries and be able to say that we have found something new, novel, innovative, significant, important, influential for the public. So the first results are under a lot of selective pressure to generate something spectacular. And when that happens, you have a winner's curse situation where it's very likely that the follow-up studies, and often these are better studies, more long-term and more appropriately done because we know exactly what we want to study, they show far less spectacular results. So for the general public, I think a good advice is that if this is the first time that you're hearing about this, this is great. It may be fascinating, but maybe wait a little bit to see what comes next.
Barbara Spellman, as someone who edits a scientific journal, the Perspectives on Psychological Science, would you agree that journals like yours should come with a sort of reader caveat that sort of read this, but don't think this is necessarily the final word?
Well, I totally agree. But my journal is not an empirical journal. It's a review and theory journal. And so one of the things I want in my review and theory pieces is for my authors who are reviewing a broad swath of literature to be able to say, well, you know, there's only been a few studies on this, so take these conclusions with a grain of salt, or there's been more studies on this, or we're worried that studies that failed to replicate haven't been published, so that we can be a bit more nuanced about what to be excited about or not.
And so, Dr. Goodman, do we have to start with the concern that this happens in part because scientists, like anyone else, want to get published, mm-hmm. they want attention, they want to be able to put forward a hypothesis that will make a difference, so there's motivation to do that? Is that part of where the problem starts? I'd like to kind of break down sort of the pieces of this and where the problem begins in your judgment.
Yeah. So I think you're referring very broadly to the issue of incentives. And what are the incentives to produce or research that is true and that will hold up versus research that is publishable and that will get attention? And when you look at the incentives within almost any setting, it can be in private industry, it can be in academia, you see that most of the incentives are towards more volume and dramatic results. Now, that is not to say that anybody is acting, in a sense, dishonestly or responding in a necessarily conscious way to the incentives. There are not necessarily incentives that look at the longevity of the findings, how often the findings actually are reversed. I'll just cite one issue that related to this, I can't imply motivation, but I did a study just several years ago with a colleague, Karen Robinson, that looked at whether clinical trials in a particular area in which many similar clinical trials had been published cited the prior work. And what we found was no matter how much prior work had been done, no matter how much, whether it was 5, 10, 15, 50%, only 50% of the studies cited either none of it or only one prior study, even if there was much as 15 or 20 prior studies. Now, what are the motivations for that? It's a little bit hard to say. Was it willful blindness? Was it actually thinking, perhaps incorrectly, that their study was unique when it wasn't? It's a little hard to say. So it's hard to talk about motivation, but we can look at incentive structures in all these places. And it's generally true that volume and, as John said, positive findings are rewarded more than the longevity of the findings.
I remember a researcher telling me once, well-known researcher in Parkinson's disease, who said it's okay to sleep with your hypotheses, but you don't want to marry it. Is that part of the problem, John? Is that people get too close to the very thing that they want to prove?
Absolutely. I think that this is a very common phenomenon. I think that it happens to me as well, as to any scientist. And I think that the remedy for that is to have the scientific method operate the way that it should, which means that you have colleagues who would try to replicate what you have proposed and find that you're correct or that you got it wrong. It also means that there should be some transparency and opportunities to do that. So, for example, would the data sets and the protocols for that original effort to address the hypothesis be available to others to double check, to scrutinize the evidence, to build the next study, to combine these data with the next study and see what we get after several pieces of evidence are put together? There's also issues about what type of incentives we give to people to do that. How strongly are they rewarded or not rewarded at all? When they share their data, when they make their protocols visible and transparent, when they're willing to share in collaborative research. I think in many fields we have made tremendous progress because we moved away from the siloed one scientist, one lab, one bench type of research to large-scale collaboration of many scientists who join forces and share everything that they have.
Are there some fields, Barbara Spellman, that are better at that sort of collaboration and sharing than others? As you look at this more broadly, are we more prone to see that effort to share and therefore sort of built-in checks and balances in one particular field than another?
I have to say I'm not totally sure, although speaking to people, say, in physics and chemistry, they tell me that they're way more open to sharing all of their protocols, their materials, their solutions, whatever it is, and to expect other labs to try to replicate it and to report when they don't and to get published or at least notification when they don't. And so I think that is a huge problem in psychology research. And related to what Steve and John is saying is that the first one gets a big splash and then other people try to do the same thing. They try to follow the protocols as best as they can. They do the experiments. And if they don't work out, they think, oh, we did something wrong. Hmm. And that information gets buried. And so the field doesn't know how many other people have tried and have failed.
Is part of what ought to happen then, and I know this is happening in some areas of disease research, that foundations that fund research or the National Institutes of Health or whoever mandate collaboration, mandate that data be shared so that there are more kind of more eyes on the problem?
They certainly are major players. I'm currently serving on an Institute of Medicine committee to try to set up policies for exactly this. And this was a committee that was co-sponsored by the FDA and the NIH and the MRC, as well as a lot of companies. And the NIH is a major – the funders are a major player. But that said, the actual technical means by which sharing occurs is not that simple. That's one problem. Mm-hmm. But the other problem is, as John alluded to, is that the researchers themselves are not in any way rewarded for the sharing. And the sharing is actually quite difficult. You have to put in a huge amount of effort these days, for example, to de-identify the data and to put it on a stable platform that is in a place where that will exist for a long time. So it's not a simple process, but it would really help not just if they mandated sharing, but if they did, as actually the director of the NIH just recently announced they would do, is to institute a new data identifier. He said they're going to call it the Data Discovery Index, even though they haven't developed it yet, whereby any papers that are written on the basis of data that you shared, you would get credit for. And if that was done, it would turn the incentives completely on their head, and it would create a carrot and not just a stick. So we need both.
How significant a problem is this in terms of sort of the everyday decision-making that happens, whether that's public policy decisions on something as huge as climate change, John Ioannidis, or whether or not I should take vitamin E on the more personal level? Is it your assessment that both public policy decisions and personal health decisions, to use those two examples, that we make not very good judgments because we're basing them on research that really doesn't hold water?
Well, clearly research is the best way, if not the only way, to really inform decisions, both for individual level issues, also at a policy level for our whole society. And if we don't have correct evidence, we're likely to make decisions that are not really the best. Climate change, we have the advantage that we have a community that is highly sensitized to these issues and is highly collaborative and sharing information and really having very high quality evidence. So I think that we have very strong evidence about climate change and the importance of human activities to that. And then the question becomes whether we can influence really political decisions based on that evidence. In other areas where there is less collaboration, less sharing, less focus on replication, less transparency, the incentive structures are not well aligned, I think we do get a lot of scares. We do get a lot of advice that is not really the best for people on what they should do with their lives. And it could really create a lot of confusion to people on what they should do, what they should not do. People get confused. They hear that there's so many risks and they cannot recognize that smoking, for example, is killing millions of people. We expect to have about a billion people dying from smoking over the next century, while getting a little bit of one particular nutritional supplement is probably not going to make a big difference in their health.
So it's a problem of perspective and scale in part. And is that where the media comes into this equation, Stephen Goodman, that we're drawn to if, for example, we see that something is reported or that our chances of getting a particular condition go from 1 in 100 to 2 in 100, well, we can say the headline is you're twice as likely to get this condition, which sounds like, scary stuff, but it's still 2 in 100. I mean, is that part of where we need to get better on my end of this story?
Well, I should bring you into some of our classes that teach medical students as well, because you've certainly hit right on one issue, which is that some of these many, elevated risks are actually very, very tiny when you look at it. So you say the chance for brain cancer has, gone up 4 times in a certain age group. You find out that the actual baseline risk was only 1 in 100,000. So the additional risk may be a little more than stepping off a sidewalk in San Francisco and not looking at the light. But there are other issues that afflict media coverage, which is the media likes conflict, likes news, things that are new. And one example I use in my talks is an article that appeared in the New York Times some years ago about magnets and shoes. And in big letters in the subhead, they highlighted a finding that runs counter to many previous studies. And this is apparently what made it newsworthy. and they highlighted that. Obviously, what they should have learned from that highlighted piece is that it's probably not true, that it doesn't actually counter all that body of evidence before. But to the extent that the media does highlight these seemingly new and novel findings in the context of many, many other studies that point in the other direction, it has to be very, very careful. And that's what rattles the public and it sometimes inappropriately decreases confidence in what they hear.
Barbara Spellman, so many of these things, and I'm again speaking about the media part of this, we do many topics on this radio series, for example, as do many media outlets, on things that have to do with human behavior, on parenting, for example. Parenting involvement good or no, now there's a New York Times story that's saying parenting involvement actually isn't so good. And so around and around we go because it's sort of sexy and interesting and it strikes people where they live. What advice do you have about both to media and to consumers about studies that purport something about parenting, for example, and how we ought to better sift through them?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny about the media and scientists both, right? We're living in this world of incentives that wants us to come up with things that are new and flashy and exciting and things that people might be able to use. As a consumer, or to consumers, I would argue that you need to be more cautious about the new, great, best thing and to see whether it fits with other, is consistent with other psychological or medical findings.
And let's talk through, before we go to our break in just a moment, some of where problems start to arise. One of the things that you've reported on, John Ioannidis, is that the studies that sometimes get the most attention are the ones that show big effects. Take this, this pill has been shown to reduce this risk by X amount or whatever. But those often seem to be studies where it's based on a very small sample size. And then when you go about trying to replicate that in larger reports or larger studies, that same finding doesn't occur.
This is almost an expectation. You would expect to see that happen under the very best intentions. If you have a lot of very small studies being done, the ones that get the most spectacular results are the ones that were most lucky, or in a way that were most unlucky to do that. So we have a situation where small studies that make it to the surface of publicity by default tend to be exaggerated. It doesn't mean that necessarily they're bad, although one might argue that small studies in general tend also to have some other caveats in terms of their quality of their design and their implementation. The mere notion that someone started a very small study and didn't go for a more definitive one might be a hint that there may be other issues besides just the luck or unluck of getting the spectacular result.
And why is it that a study of a relatively small sample size, sometimes like 20 or 30 subjects, right, can get published? It seems odd when you think about that in comparison to polling and social science research, where no poll gets published unless they've done they've talked to 500 people in some political campaign. And yet a scientific study can get published when it's tested something in maybe 20 people, right? Isn't that kind of crazy, Stephen Goodman?
Well, again, I should bring you in to teach our classes. So at the journals I work, sometimes we actually try to put our hands over the results and say, would we want to publish this regardless of what the result is? And in some small studies, you actually would say yes, depending on the treatment and the condition. But there are many, many studies where if you didn't know what they found, you wouldn't say that you would be interested in what they did find. I will say, though, that one of the issues in the new world of electronic publishing in this gigantic journal universe is that virtually any study is going to be publishable somewhere. If you have a study and you've written it up and it's not published, it's only because you haven't tried hard enough. So it's harder, of course, to get into the top journals, but the kinds of studies that sometimes get into the news are not just those. You can get into the literature somewhere. So your point is an extremely good one. I wouldn't make too broad a statement about all small studies, but there are many studies that if we didn't know the dramatic result, we wouldn't publish just on the basis of the sample size. That's true.
Stephen Goodman joining us along with John Ioannidis. They are co-directing a new initiative at Stanford called the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford, METRICS for short. It's an effort to try to encourage better practices when it comes to research processes. We're joined also by Barbara Spellman at the University of Virginia, where she edits Perspectives on Psychological Science. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this conversation. What are some of the questions you have about research that's going on? What are headlines that you've seen that you're now scratching your head about and wondering whether or not they're valid? You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Post your thoughts and questions on our Facebook page or on our website at all. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, how reliable are scientific studies in general? When you read a published report, does that mean it's necessarily valid? A number of scientists are calling some of those studies into question, wanting to focus our attention more on how we can produce and replicate scientific research in a more consistent way. Joining us to take up that conversation, John Ioannidis and Stephen Goodman, who co-direct the new Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford, and Barbara Spellman, editor-in-chief of Perspectives on Psychological Science. We'd love to have you you join us as well at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Lots of interesting questions coming in. Let's go to some of our emails first. One listener writes, this is fascinating. I'm curious if this phenomenon has been consistent over time, holding the total amount of published research constant, or has this been growing over time? How long has this problem been going on, would you say, John Ioannidis?
This is a very difficult question, and I don't think that we have a very good answer for that because most of the research that has been done on research has been looking on single fields, not the vast scientific enterprise that is comprised of about 15 million scientists publishing about 3 million papers per year currently. I think that there's some problems that have become more prominent lately. For example, in terms of the funding, there's more scientists competing for a pretty much steady, if not shrinking, amount of funding. And obviously, some of the problems that we described, like the need to be more competitive and show even more spectacular results and even promise that you can do something very fancy and very exciting and extravagant, is probably likely to be more prominent if you have a smaller pie for a larger number of scientists. So what does it mean? I think it means we need more funding for science, and we need obviously funding for good science.
Here's another
Can
question.
I add something?
Yes, go ahead, Barbara Stillman.
Yeah, I think that there's two sides of this problem, right? One is that it might be going on more. We don't know. But the other is that we're finding out more about it more quickly and more frequently as we have more means of disseminating information. So it used to be, say, that my lab couldn't replicate somebody else's lab. We kept it to ourselves. But now, you know, we might blog about it or email about it, and then we hear other people who have the same problem. So it's on both sides. We worry about it happening more, but we also think we're learning about it more.
Well, let's tackle a little bit more the problem of replicability, which is one of the questions that comes up a lot. And one of our posters writes, a researcher apparently, in my field, one of the problems is what's called internal validity, meaning you can't replicate results even given the exact data and analysis because researchers aren't required to submit their data and analysis code with research papers. It's always struck me that one solution would be requiring the release of both the data and the code used in the analysis. Help me sort through that problem, Stephen Goodman, about what that means, that that it's not only that you can't replicate it, it's that even if you have the data, you can't replicate it because you don't have the key, so to speak. You don't have the code.
Yes. Yeah, so the scientific results or statistical results are produced not just by the data, but then you put them through a program, a statistical program that does the comparisons and creates the tables and the tests that you see in the paper. And one issue is how did you go from that data to to what's actually published? And there's always a question about whether the judgments or even the actual procedures that were described in the paper were either done properly or were done as described. And although I don't know that this is the biggest problem, that is, that if you use the same procedures, you'll get different results. Usually the problems are a little bit further upstream. It's part of the issue, and this goes, again, to that issue of data sharing.
Yep.
How can we develop structures so that researchers are not just mandated to share, but actually have a benefit of sharing their data for replication and reproduction?
On the question of replication, I was reading an article last night in the New York Times that cited this example from Amgen, the biotech firm, and that their chief scientific officer, a fellow by the name of Glenn Begley, wrote that of 53 different cancer papers that they tried to replicate, they could only replicate six. So 47 out of 53, they couldn't replicate, which is seems to me at least stunning, John Ioannidis. Is that the norm, that really most findings that are published can't be replicated?
It's very difficult to say that this is the norm. This is a very interesting study, and it's really shocking. And there have been other studies trying to do the same thing from other companies that tried to replicate papers that were very influential in the academic world and would inform some of their R&D agenda. and they got pretty similar results. So we have at least three different efforts of this sort of reproducibility showing pretty low replicability rate. It's something that I think we need more data, and it's something that we need to pay more attention. There's other efforts like the Reproducibility Initiative at the moment that is trying to reproduce the most influential and cited papers in cell biology. There's parallel efforts in psychology. There's a lot of discussion about what we could do in other medical fields and beyond.
Is there a rule of thumb about this, that something should be replicated three times before you know it's true, Barbara Spellman? Is there any kind of rule about that? It's like, you know, reporters with sources, you want to have at least a couple of sources before you publish something?
No, we don't have any exact rules about that right now, although many of the things we've talked about up till now are relevant. For example, what is your sample size? Has it been replicated by other labs as opposed to just the same lab several times? So there's several criteria that might be relevant, but as of now, I don't know of any hard, fast rule.
Is that the kind of thing that you're interested in doing at the new center, Stephen Goodman and John Ioannidis, having sort of certain protocols, certain standards, certain best practices that would say if you meet these tests and it's replicated three times, you're good to go?
Well, I would say in a general sense, absolutely. That's precisely the kind of thing we're interested in, whether it will be an algorithm and a set of criteria as you put them forth. I don't think it will be quite like that, but certainly we're interested in both studying and putting forth principles and policies by which people could so people could judge the degree of confidence they have in a particular result.
Here's from some of our listeners this morning. Dave joins us first in Philadelphia. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the sample size issue that you were talking about before. One of the worries that I have, this is great, this has to be done, but one of the worries I have is that lay people might get the idea that they shouldn't trust scientific research. Specifically, when it comes to sample size, if you were to do a within-subjects experiment and you had 50 people and that experiment got replicated three times, the odds are that that's a true finding. And so I wouldn't want people to look at anything that didn't have hundreds or thousands of subjects and think, regardless of the design, regardless of what they were investigating, that's not a reliable experiment. That's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, fair enough, Dave. Thank you. Steve Goodman or John Ioannidis, comments on Dave's observation?
I think it's a fair statement, and one has to be very careful on how sample size is defined because, for example, there could be studies that have a smaller number of participants, but they have very intensive measurements and hundreds and thousands and millions of
and maybe
observations.
Followed over time.
And maybe followed over a long time. So in a way, we're talking about the richness of the study in information. And this is not always very easy to decipher just by hearing that it's a study of 50 people or 5,000 people.
Let's go to Candy next in San Francisco. Candy, go ahead.
So I had a comment to make, and it really has to do with the whole premise of why we publish in the literature. And, of course, that's for people to replicate the work and to really understand the entire body of the literature. And I think one of the comments that Barbara Spellman made, she sort of touched on it, and which is the concept of publication bias, and that is that journals are not as likely to publish negative findings as they are to publish something that's very favorable or significant effect. And so, you know, that dilutes out the total body of evidence. And I think that's an important concept, especially today in our media-obsessed world, where one day someone hears that a particular drug has a favorable effect, and then the other day it doesn't. And so consumers are left with, okay, what do I make of this? Instead of looking at the big picture and saying, here's everything we know and here's all the science that's been published, and what does the total body of evidence suggest? And so I thought maybe your panelists can comment on that.
Yeah, Candy, thanks so much. Great question. Barbara Spellman, why don't you start us out?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great point. And I think one of the things we need to do is step back and look at kind of the history of the development of science in a way. You know, we were saying before, people would publish studies with 20 or 30 subjects. You know what? A while ago, that was hard to do. It was hard to get 20 or 30 subjects and do what you were doing. Now, in many fields, and at least in some of the psychology we do, it's really very easy, and you can do lots and lots of studies very, very quickly. So the pressure now is not on finding the subjects. The pressure now is on collecting all the literature, collecting what's been done, and putting it together. Mm-hmm. And I think we haven't been taking enough advantage of the technology available to do that, to pay attention to the what we might call negative findings, and to collect everything and to put it together and to understand it better that way.
Such an interesting point, because it's I'll just speak from the media side of this. We're much more likely to gravitate towards a report that says if you eat butter four times a day, this will happen to you, than seven studies that show that nothing happens to you, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we're drawn to something that says that makes a dent. Stephen Goodman?
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about publication bias, and it is a big problem. I think it's actually
And by publication bias, meaning
yes.
the kinds of things that are more likely to get published.
Yeah, right, and that there's a certain section of literature that is not published. There's actually a misconception that this is on the part of the journals. The journal decisions sometimes determine where it appears, but once it's written up and submitted, it gets published somewhere. But what we are finding, and this is actually just a relatively new study done by the NIH that looked at how many of the NIH-funded studies, these are the premier studies, are not being published. And they found, and again, this is a number that's been consistent by people studying it in different ways over 20, 25 years, but this is just very recently, they found that about 30% of their own funded studies were not being published. And this is not because journals are rejecting them. It's because the investigators, for whatever reason, are not submitting them. Either the study wasn't finished or it was finished, they thought it was uninteresting. So there is a section of the literature, and it could be a good section, that it's simply not even there.
So as you were saying before, it's not necessarily that hard to find someone who will publish it. This is
correct.
This is self editing. I mean, these are researchers saying, I'm not going to submit this, perhaps because it's research that doesn't back up their favorite hypothesis.
It could be, and we don't always know exactly why, but we do know that this number, somewhere between 30% and 50% of literature never making it into the light of day, it has been pretty robust. And then even when it does, as Dr. Spellman said, we often don't make optimal use of it. We don't refer to it in making our claims.
Mike writes in, the largest problem in academic publishing is that publishing in peer-reviewed journals, whether the research is actually informative or not, is all that matters. Many times this leads to research that's statistically significant but mm-hmm. practically irrelevant. Would you concur with that, Johnny Anunis?
Well, I think that under the current pressure, it's very likely that you will see lots of papers that are just statistically significant, but they don't have a chance of changing the world. I'm a bit less concerned about that, because we expect that most of research that we do, even with a lot of effort and lots of dedication, will probably not change the world. This is just the odds that research is so difficult to accomplish something major, and it requires continuous investment and effort by many people. I would be more worried about trying to make results that are not really important for practical matters seem important, because then that introduces a sense of distortion, and you take a nominally significant result and you try to make a story that this should be changing practices for people and for policies and for governments and for society. And this may not well be
Karen writes in about something that got a lot of attention, and maybe it's something that is a way of getting at some of the problems that we're discussing. And here's what she writes. Not enough is done to verify results before publishing. I'm thinking of Andrew Wakefield. The BMJ published his research, quote unquote, concluding that vaccines lead to autism, despite the fact that it turns out he made up most of his data and some of his research subjects. That's an example of something that has gotten huge amount of attention, and that we're still paying the price for it to a degree in terms of the number of kids who don't get vaccinated because of concern over research that has been pretty thoroughly debunked, right, Stephen Goodman?
Yes, I know about that case very well. I think that's a fascinating example of the interplay between the media and the public and science. What might be the most interesting aspect of that story is that the original research was actually barely even made that claim. It was a very, very weak study, even fraudulent. It was a weak study. And the claim that he made that got so much traction was actually made in a press conference after it. You can't even find it in the paper. What's really interesting is, why did the hundreds and thousands and millions of kids who were then studied in subsequent research all around the world showing negative results, showing the safety of vaccines, why did that not get the same traction that this tiny little study got in a claim that was only made in a press conference. It's more almost a sociologic question, because the evidence was there and the evidence was clear. The vaccines were safe and were not causing autism, and yet the press and the actions around this particular study had exactly the effects that you claim, and we're still seeing the ripple effects today.
So Stephen Goodman staring at me across the studio at the person behind the microphone hosting these programs in a nice way. Barbara Spellman, is that sort of a big part of this, though, really, that we tend to leap to those things that are really kind of fringy, and that it's great that we're focusing on the validity of research here, but in some ways, we need to also focus on the validity of media decision-making?
Well, yeah. And, of course, this is an area that social psychologists study a lot. What is it that people are likely to believe and why? And this autism vaccine thing has got all the components of it that would make somebody be really interested in and want to believe it, right? So it's about children. It's about fear. And it's about something that, as a parent, you might do that might hurt your child. And so, you know, all these things make the message just so much more, salient and frightening.
Back to our calls. Jeff in Palo Alto joins us next. Jeff?
Hi. I wonder whether a technological approach might be useful in which you, a thing I'll call global cumulative Bayesian analysis, where you basically turn the entire literature or entire literature and subdomain into a constantly updated review article, essentially. And when things are retracted, that would bubble up through the network. And when new results are replicated, that would update the probability. You'd only ever see what amounts to a review paper.
Yeah, interesting. Jenny, you need sort of a journal of retractions, right?
No, that's not what he's proposing.
Okay. Sorry.
If I understand it correctly, the proposal, which is a very interesting one, is to have a continuously updated review of the status of evidence in a given domain. And this is an idea that has been out there for quite a while. There's some very nice initiatives that have been trying to update reviews on real-time kind of settings. For example, there's the Cochrane collaboration that has been doing that for medical interventions. There's the Campbell collaboration that has been doing it for social types of settings and interventions. And systematic reviews that are continuously updated have become very popular. But the success of such initiatives is dependent on whether we can take care of some of the other biases that we have discussed. For example, if we don't get rid of publication bias, a systematic review that is continuously updated will just continue fueling the evidence with these selectively reported and selectively published positive results. And we will get then a systematic review that says that I do see a significant result, actually with pretty high confidence, but this may just be the result of bias.
This is up your alley, Barbara Spellman. I'd like you to weigh in on this too.
Yeah, I think that in theory it's a really fabulous idea, and wouldn't it be nice to have a sort of continuous meta-analysis, like a position where if you have done a study that's relevant to some theory that a lot of people are interested in, you just send your data there regardless of how it turned out, so that there is a place that's got all of the relevant information together, and you can update it in Bayesian fashion or however you want. I don't know. I think it's possible, and I think it would be fabulous. And again, I want to reiterate, I think the biggest problem in our fields now is that we're not connecting all the information and theories that we have.
Stephen Goodman, on this idea of sort of real-time data sort of always being accessible.
Yes, I just wanted to make the point that it was exactly efforts like the Cochrane collaboration where they're trying to aggregate all the information in all fields that was really the origin of meta-research, because it was these researchers who started looking at all the pooled evidence and began to be worried about what's affecting even this aggregate. And this is just really to expand on John's point, that when you look at the aggregated evidence, that's when you begin to see the patterns that concern you about forces that affect the literature that might mislead you even if you added it all up. So the first thing we have to get is an evidence base that's reliable. And that's a lot of what we're talking about here. And then you can add it up in a continuous basis and hopefully come to more valid conclusions.
John Yanias, you sort of started all of this almost 10 years ago when you published your piece, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. Is it getting better? I mean, is there more attention within the field now that this is actually a real problem that deserves sort of focus and attention?
I think that there's a growing number of scientists and also the public that get sensitized about these issues. And I think that there have been lots of things happening, moving in the right direction in the meanwhile. So we have seen a lot of brainstorming and also some good ideas being implemented in things like registration of protocols and research and clinical trials. We have
you
seen.
You can say what registration is.
So registration means that someone before starting a clinical trial, they have to go to clinicaltrials.gov or an equivalent registry and say that I am doing the study and this is how it's going to look like. This is the basics of its protocol. So people are aware that this is happening and this is how it's happening. So it cannot really disappear completely and it cannot appear out of the blue 3 years down the road without anyone knowing that it had started. There's lots of brainstorming and efforts towards data sharing. There's lots of collaborative research happening. In some fields, this has transformed their performance, like genomics, for example. It started as siloed one-team investigators, and currently we have very big consortia that are very effective and very efficient. So I think that there's lots of good work happening, and this is exactly what we want to capture within metrics. We want to share these experiences and try to extrapolate them and see whether we can apply them more broadly across various disciplines.
John Ioannidis and Stephen Goodman co-direct that center at Stanford University, the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. Barbara Spellman, professor of law at the University of Virginia. You're listening to Forum. As you know, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to do that, go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. So this actually raises a question to me, Stephen Goodman, about how you evaluate yourselves. I mean, if this is all about sort of assessing and promoting good research, how do you know if you're a success? What will be your own metrics?
Boy, that's a challenging question. Well, what's interesting about this is that the best methods we have are still scientific methods. So we're very strong believers in science. And I think there are a variety of things that we can do. I'm going to also pass this over to John because this is a particular concern of his. But there are many ways that we can test methodology by using randomized trials on the innovations or on the recommendations that we make. And we've been talking about that, and I think we have to be held to the same standards that we hold other people.
You could have your own hypotheses and biases.
That's right. So this is a very fair question, and I think it's going to be it's the grand philosophical question of how does anybody know what anything what's true, and we don't have God to tell us. So I'd like to hear John actually weigh in on that question.
Before John weighs in, let me just interject one other point, which I think is relevant, and we really haven't talked about yet. And Barbara Spellman, respond first if you would. How can non-statisticians learn to read research? And the reason why I think that's so interesting is that it makes me wonder, Barbara Spellman, both about who does the research and who reviews it and how well trained either researchers are in statistics and how well journals and publication editors are in assessing that.
Well, researchers, at least in psychology, certainly all are trained in statistics. And when they submit their articles, we have people review them who are also trained in statistics. Although sometimes people are using statistics that are way more sophisticated, perhaps, than everybody understands. But I think, a big problem is not just is doing these statistics, but rather reporting and interpreting them in the media and to the larger audience. And for me, one of the biggest problems in all this is the very simple mistake of confusing correlation with causation. And so sometimes we know that two variables may go together. For example, as children get older, when they become two, they both get vaccinated, and that's when you start to see the signs of autism develop. And people say, oh, those two things are going together. One must be causing the other one. And to stop reporting that looks like that and to stop people from interpreting correlation as causation is a very easy thing to teach the general public, And I think, I don't know about John and Steve, but lots of my colleagues believe that some of this stuff ought to be taught way earlier, like in high school, rather than just teaching, trigonometry.
It's a good point. And let's get to a question from Margo, who wants to raise some of that same question. Margo, we just have very short on time, so just a brief question. But I know you want to get at this question of who gets taught this and at what point.
Taught this by my stepfather at Harvard Psychoacoustic Laboratory. Just for fun, he had me go over the research proposals to look for the errors. A wonderful thing. Served me all my life. For Scientific American, 40 years later, I found errors that the scientists had missed because I knew how the equations must balance. I hope that I'm so pleased for metrics. Will you be bringing it down to the high school and college elementary level so we can all learn to be good to question scientific research?
Margo, thank you. It's a good question about where this starts. I mean, your focus, can it reach down at least to undergraduates at Stanford?
Well, that's very interesting. I think that science is the noblest endeavor of the human mind, and I would argue that humans should be trained in science very early on. So I'm not sure whether that starts at age two or even earlier, possibly. But using the scientific method and trying to be critical and questioning and coming up with hypotheses and testing them is something that should probably happen very, very early on.
And very briefly, Stephen Goodman, one thing I know you wanted to get to and we have not, but one caveat you think is important for people when they're reading these studies is to also make sure that they look at whether or not something is safe and that doesn't always get reported out in particular studies.
Yes, thanks for asking that. One of the number one concerns we have when we talked about partial reporting is that the safety of what we do or take is fully reported, and that study after study has shown is either unreported, misreported, or not reported at all.
Plenty of work for all of us to do, both research scientists and media alike. I want to thank both John Ioannidis, Stephen Goodman, and Barbara Spellman for being part of our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.